Okay, let's give a warm Tulare County welcome to our warm-up speaker, former Exeterite, Roger. Former, you're always an Exeterite if you're from Exeter. My name's Roger W., and I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to just met Rick tonight, thank Rick, and thank my sponsor Ernie for telling me I had to do this tonight. It's been a while since I've actually done a speaker meeting where I was actually the person I had to speak. But, well, where to start? I am from Exeter, from a nice line of alcoholics out of Exeter. A cousin of mine, Don Wilson, recently died. He was, I guess, well known around here in these parts or by a few people. There's a lot of drunks in the Wilson family, but you know, what are you going to do? My sobriety date is September 20th, 1992, and you know, luckily I got 20 years this year, and hopefully I'll have more. But you know, it wasn't always. Well, I'll just tell you what it was like. You know, I'm just kind of a garden variety drunk. Started drinking at good old Exeter High School in the orange groves where a lot of folks drank. You know, that was kind of our fun part, just get out of there and start drinking. And I can still remember, like it was yesterday, even though I was like 15 years old, the first drink I had, and it was outside of Exeter toward Lemon Cove and the Orange Grove. And I remember drinking a few beers and just feeling wonderful. Just wonderful. I hated the drink. I didn't like the taste of it, but man, I felt wonderful. And I was walking around, it was a moonlit night, and I can remember the road just coming up and hitting me in the face when I fell over. And I still thought it was wonderful. I just loved the way I felt. And of course I got sick, and you know, like we all do when we're new, or at least most of us anyway, but I continued to do it. And so every weekend I had a best friend who was also a good drinking buddy, and that's all we did. We chased it every weekend, getting beer and going out and drinking. And so that's just the way it was, and I thought it was normal to every weekend to get drunk. And so I left Exeter, went up to Fresno to go to school, and continued every weekend drinking. And then eventually it turned to, you know, two or three nights a week drinking. And then I ended up at this place where I work. And it's funny because I met my wife at this job. And she didn't know me when I was new, though. And I remember we would get a 10 o'clock break and a 3 o'clock break, and we would run out and get a beer at 10 o'clock and 3 o'clock. And it was some engineering company I worked for. And the guys that worked there, that was normal for them, too. So I guess we're all just a bunch of drunks. I know the owner was. That's pretty obvious. But so I continued to drink and had the typical run-ins with the law, but never anything really serious. Nothing serious. And that's probably unfortunate, but I never had anything serious happen to me. I had trouble with relationships because I was a liar, cheat, and a thief, just like most of us were. And I, you know, was not very good at that. I had a practice wife for a few years. That didn't last. And then I decided to continue with school and go away to college, and I went to Madison, Wisconsin. And there's a lot of drinking in Wisconsin too. And there I got to the point where I was drinking probably three or four times a week, and I would do the drinking before the drinking. I remember buying beer and drinking in my room before I went out drinking with my friends in college. And prior to that, I met and married my wife, my current wife. She's no longer, she's not a practice wife. She's my permanent wife. And she was pregnant out here in California, and my son was going to be born any time. And I'll be honest, that was freaking me out a little bit. So I was out there in Madison, and I was drinking a lot. And I knew it was going to be, he's due any time, but I didn't know the exact date. Long story short, I go out and I do something stupid, and I end up in jail. And of course, he's born when I'm in jail. And so nobody can find me because I'm in Madison and in jail. And her dad somehow finds me and tells her that your sorry husband's in jail. You know, but that was a real eye-opener for me because, like I said, I came from a long line of drugs. I grew up in an alcoholic household. And there's chaos in an alcoholic household. You know, I didn't know what dad I would have any week, really. And then there were times that he just wouldn't show up. And that was normal for me. And then laying there, though, in that jail cell, when my son was born out here, God intervened. You know, that's the only way I can describe it. God intervened and said, you know what, you can stop this. And I didn't know how to stop it, but I had to stop it because I didn't want him growing up with what I had grown up with. And so I did what was actually suggested to me by a lawyer who came to assist me with my problem and said, you look, based on what I've seen here and what you've told the officers, you're a drunk. I had never been called a drunk. I didn't like being labeled a drunk. But I would do anything at the time because I wanted to get out of trouble. What I'd done is I'd vandalized some building and then passed out somewhere. The next morning I got up and called the cops. Said, hey, I think I broke this building. And said, yeah, we got a report. Stay right there and we'll come get you. So they came and got me. You know. And they were pretty nice about it. They didn't put any handcuffs on me or anything, but they took me into some room and interrogated, and I just told them everything, right? So there was really no defense except being drunk. And this, actually she was a lawyer in training, she said, you can go to this program and it'll look good for the court. So of course I said, sure, let's do that. So it was an outpatient program at night, let's call it during the day. And I got introduced to AA. And we were assigned kind of a pseudo-sponsor who made us work the steps in this 90-day, I don't think it was 90 days, maybe it was only 30 days. And so we had to work the entire set of steps in 30 days. And of course, that's not really a good way to do it, but we did it. And so I had to look at myself a little bit of an inventory. It wasn't much of one, but it was enough to introduce me to the program. And then I heard enough stories about people like me because, you know, when I went to meetings in Madison, the first meeting I went to, I subsequently learned, was an Alano club. I didn't know what it was at the time. I just went to the top because they gave us this list of meetings. And it was an old house converted into meeting rooms upstairs and downstairs. And it was a smoking meeting, and they had coffee cups, the crap you read about now in the old AA. And you had to wash the cups, and there was ashtrays and all that crap. And I hated it. I hated it because I was young, you know, upwardly mobile, going to college, and here are these old farts smoking and just drunks. But I kept going back because every now and then I'd hear somebody say something, and they didn't look like me. They didn't talk like I did. They didn't have the same life experiences. They hadn't come from Exeter or whatever. But, you know, they did the same stupid shit I did. And I liked hearing that because for a while there I thought it was crazy. Because I would do things and I would think things. I would think about drinking. And I don't know if anybody else did that, but I thought I was a little crazy because I was thinking about drinking. These people did too. They said, oh yeah, we think about drinking all the time. Well, what do you do to stop it? And so they would help me and they would tell me what they did to not think about drinking, or at least to think about it and to don't act on it. And so I was attracted to that. And soon thereafter, I learned that there are non-smoking meetings, and there are meetings that have younger people in it instead of these old farts. And so I would go to these meetings, and I liked the AA part. I didn't so much like this outpatient thing I was doing, but I liked the AA part. And so I was attracted to it. And then I graduated and came back here, and was just met with an uncertainty. I mean, my wife, Jerry's here, she knows. I mean, I didn't have a job. I had this small person that I needed to take care of. It just wasn't pretty. I didn't like going to meetings. I went to this meeting in Clovis. I hated it. And somehow, things just worked out. I don't know how, but some things, I do know how now in retrospect, God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. That's kind of my mantra throughout my program. Even when I was drinking, I didn't die because God intervened. Should have died several times, you know. Got through, went to law school, picked up a sponsor in law school for a week. Didn't like him. Then I started going to a men's meeting in Fresno. And there, and I felt at home then. It was strictly a men's tag meeting called Rule 62. I don't know if they have it down here or not. And really was attracted to this gay guy named Ray. Because, you know, and he knows him if you don't know him. At the time, he had a flat top, and he lives down here now. And he goes to a lot of meetings here.
He's a speaker next month.
Yeah, he goes by Reyes now. You know, but when I knew him, it was just Reyes. Now he's Reyes. And you know what? He had what I wanted. Now I didn't want to be gay. That's not good. You know? But he was happy, and he'd gone through some really serious crap in his life. He was happy. He knew how to work a program, which I really didn't know or have a feel for it at the time. And he seemed spiritually fit. And I was starting to get attracted to this whole spiritual part of the program. And I would listen to him speak, and we would talk before the meeting, after the meeting, and then eventually we'd talk at different times. And he just showed me how to work the AA program. Because when I read the book, and I know how to read. I've read the book 100 times, and I still didn't know how to do the program. I need somebody to show me. Ray showed me how to do the program. You know, he said, get up in the morning, make your bed, pray. And it's crap. He goes, no, do that. And so I started doing that. You know, maybe not making the bed so much. But I would get up in the morning, the first thing I'd do is pray. And that became a habit. And guess what? Things got better. You know, when you put God first, things get better. And it's just funny how that works. And Gay Ray would tell me to do those things. And I just love that guy. I still love him. I still call him today. You know, he's kind of my relationship guy. You know, I don't use Ernie for that. You know, if I need to talk to Ray about something, he's right there for me. And we eventually progressed on in our lives in Fresno. Got a house. Ray helped me move. AA guys are there to help us move. And then I picked up another sponsor. And damn it, if he didn't go out. After 17 years, he decided to go out. And I worked the steps with him in great detail at like year 9 of my sobriety. And he taught me a lot. He's the first person that actually said that I was vindictive. And I didn't understand what he meant by that. He says, you keep score of things that other people do that you think they do to you. And he got that out of my fourth and fifth step. And he says, yeah, you're vindictive. I said, no, I'm the nicest guy in the world. He says, no, you keep score and you want to hurt the other person. You know, not physically, but emotionally and that sort of thing. And so that was a real eye-opener. But anyway, he had issues apparently because he decided to go out after 17 years. But he had another sponsor. And again, I was always told, find somebody that has something that you like. And I was attracted to this guy who, again, you know, he'd been in a long-term relationship with his wife. He seemed to be calm, and he had a great spiritual program. You know, I'm very attracted to the spiritual side of AA. And David S. Became my sponsor, and it was weird because at the time, we were kind of on other sides of the fence in our professions. I was the prosecutor, he was the defense attorney. And so he was always bitching about prosecutors, and I was always bitching about defense attorney. And he, you know, but we were attached to each other. And he helped me immeasurably with the spiritual program. He would basically just, you know, he followed Ray's, you know, get up and put God first. But then he also, you know, had other things to do. And damn it, he didn't die. He got sick and died. You know? And I was pretty pissed about that. Because he was a great example of a person who had gone through a lot in his life, really hit bottom pretty hard, and picked himself up and was just happy about the simple things. He had this old dog, Rusty. He just loved Rusty. And he lived in the middle of, he has a real nice place on top of a hill in, near, it's a course culver, or Oakhurst, yeah. And he just loved that place, and he seemed like he had everything going on. He'd get sick, gets diagnosed and dies in 6 months. You know, it was just crap. But you know what? Ernie came along. And again, attracted to Ernie because of the spiritual program. I can't say enough about that, because I know that God has taken care of me so many ways that, you know, you just don't know until you start looking back in time. And I've had enough time to look back. And I don't worry so much about drinking. You know, sometimes I do. If I've had a lot of stress going on in the week or whatever, I'll think about drinking, but now I have enough time to where I think through the process. You know, where's it going to get me? Well, it's going to get me drunk. It's probably going to get me in jail. Probably going to lose my profession, lose my family, be a bad example to my son. You know, my son's 20. So like I said, my sobriety date and his birthday are the same. And so when I turned 20, he turned 20. And so he's never seen me drunk. When I bring him down to Exeter and he starts talking to some of my old Exeter friends, they tell stories about what Dad was like. He doesn't know that person. You know, that person doesn't exist to him. I tell him it's true just to try to be an example to him. But I'll be honest, I would let him down, and that would hurt me more if I had to let him down, if I was drinking. But I still think about it, even after all this time. I still think about it. But the thing that I think is most important to me now, or the things that are important to Ernie, are the spiritual aspects of the program. You know, and I know I keep harping on that, but that's really what's important to me. Because I don't obsess about drinking like I used to. You know, as I said before, when I was before in life, it was I thought about drinking all the time. I had to drink before I went out and drink with my friends. I don't think about that much anymore. So the obsession's gone, but the escapism, I want to run from all the stuff that's going on. And I know that if I drank, I could escape it, and it would work, you know, for about 30 seconds. And then I'd get sober, or at least come to, and it'd all be there. And probably be worse than what I left. So I think that through and don't do it. And then I also, you know, I pray a lot. And I don't want to trivialize that either. I pray all the time. I'll be driving down the road and I'll be flipping my finger at somebody, and then I'll know it's wrong and I'll have to pray about it. You know, while I'm driving. Because that, I think, is the thing that centers me the most. To get back to the spiritual program. I really like the 10th, 11th, and 12th steps. I live those things pretty much every day, because that's what keeps me spiritually fit. As long as I'm spiritually fit, I can handle anything. I mean, really anything. About a year ago, in fact, it almost was exactly a year ago, November 1, my dad died. And we had a service here in Visalia. And it was weird. Jerry was around. I had a half-brother, and it turned out I didn't have a half-brother. And I learned that after my dad died, between his death and his funeral, that, oh no, that was all bullshit that we've been telling you for the last 50 years. And it's really, okay. Then why is he here at the funeral? It was just, you know, I didn't want to drink. I wanted to choke some people, but I didn't want to drink. And I talk to people in AA, you know, because you people in the room save me every day. I don't care if you're new or if you got 40 years. Working with newcomers, I did at lunch today, working with a newcomer whose best thinking, you got him in jail, whose best thinking is telling him he shouldn't go to rehab. And this friend of mine, Mike, and I are telling him, guess what, your best thinking is lying to you. It's getting you in trouble. You need to surrender and listen to us. I don't know if you will or not, but you guys, when I messed up, when I come to a meeting, I listen to you. I listen to the newcomers, I listen to the old-timers, because you get to tell me what to do. Even though I think, you know, sometimes I'm smarter than everybody, usually I'm screwed up when I do, but you guys tell me what to do. And I didn't come to AA to get that. I came to AA to learn how to drink. Because I knew that I couldn't drink, I always got drunk, and eventually went to jail. So I thought I'd come to AA and learn how to drink. Because I couldn't imagine being in my profession without drinking. You know, I have to have drinking lunches, I have to have drinking dinners. And guess what? I don't do any of that now. What I got out of AA is a better way of living. And I have problems today, but the quality of my problems is so much better than what they used to be. You know, I'm racing down here and I get a ticket, big deal. I didn't do it. I didn't get a ticket. But I was racing. Jerry told me, you can race into an aim. You know, that's my problem today. I might be late. I'm not in jail. I'm not drunk. My family's still intact. And I get to come to the meeting. You know, I get to see old guys like this in the 49ers jacket sleeping. He always does that. You know what I didn't expect is coming down this far from the valley is all the San Francisco crap. What is all that San Francisco crap? Are there any Dodger people around here? Right. And I go to San Francisco and Fresno, I expect that because I think they're Northern California. And I come down here and it's very disappointing. Anyway, I asked Ernie when he volunteered me to be here tonight, what am I going to speak about? And he goes, speak about me. So what can I say about Ernie? Ernie is very calm, and I like that. And he's calm. Because, you know, I'm a defense attorney, and usually they're always fighting each other. And they come to me because they've got the trouble, and they're scared. And so I like the calm. I like to see Ernie because he's calm. I don't always like his answers, you know. But if I think about him for more than 5 minutes, you're usually right. So Ernie has been a godsend to me. He has. He doesn't know it, but he has. He knows it now. He thinks it all the time. But I'm glad he asked me to do this. I enjoy coming to play because I come enjoy seeing other meetings, see how they run. And I thank you for allowing me to share.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's give our featured speaker a big celerity welcome. Ernie B. from Clovis, California.
Hi, I'm Ernie, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Ernie.
I'd like to thank Rick for asking me to come down and speak, and thank him for a wonderful dinner for my wife and I that he took us to, and I tell you, it was really delicious. I feel like I ought to be sharing from a couch. I'm about 8 o'clock at night. My age will start slowing down, and with a full stomach, it's really, really an invitation to relax. And anyway, it's good to be here. It's good to be at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Good in some ways, in a different way than ever before in my recovery. I retired from 28 years of service with the state of California in December of last year, and managed to busy myself a lot with, you know, those projects that we all have. I think Al-Anon say about alcoholics, no project's finished until it's half done. And that was true in my drinking, and it's a little less true. It's progress, not perfection, and it's less true in my recovery. But I had a lot of those. Live on a little ranch out in the country in kind of north of Fresno. And the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is based on one alcoholic talking to another. Okay, that's how the disease stays in remission. That's what I was taught. The way the disease works that I have is one alcoholic talking to himself. You know, and my great tendency, just like when I was drinking, it carries over into sobriety, is to isolate. Always to withdraw and pull back. It's better today than it was when I was drinking. It's better today than it was when I was new. But this retirement thing and living on the ranch and having all these unfinished projects, and you know how we're always thinking of new things to do and we're always trying to make it better and perfect it. You know, that obsessive mind kicks in. It's just not about drinking. It's the project. And it gets better and better, and everybody's clapping and saying it looks great. Pretty soon they're going, Ernie, you need to let it go. It's good enough. You know what I mean? It's like, that's taken me away from a lot of my regular meetings and commuting all the way into town just to go to a meeting. My head wants to tell me the price of gas, my time, blah, blah, blah. So it's really good to be here because I don't know if any of you out there have never been asked to speak. And you may be thinking, oh God, someday they'll ask me to do this and it scares me to death, or I don't want to do it, I'm too shy or bashful or whatever. But I can tell you it does more for me as a speaker probably than it will for any of you, because I get to kind of slow down, and instead of telling my story or something about me or some topic we're on or some step we're talking about, instead of some little 3 to 5 minute increment, I get to look at the whole thing a little bit more and reflect on it and share it. And that's always, I found, always been good for me. So what it was like for me was, like, and Roger, thanks for that warm-up. You did a great job, and I'm proud of you. And it was a lot the same. You know, I mean, I started drinking, well, I started opening beer cans for my dad with a church key back in the 50s and sipping the foam off the top from an age I can't remember. I was real little. But the drinking really started to happen in junior high school. I changed schools. I wanted to be in the popular group. And my dad was a pretty heavy drinker even then. And we always had a lot of booze in the house. He only drank a couple of types, but his being in business, you know, every Christmas we'd have all these pretty little boxes, you know, those long thin boxes with a bow on top under the Christmas tree, and they would be customers and clients that would give him booze for Christmas, and he didn't drink any of it. You know, they'd be wines and different hard liquors that he didn't drink, and he had this whole cabinet full of this stuff. So I was one of those 14-year-olds who could sneak a whole bottle, and it would never be noticed. I mean, this stuff would just get dusty in there, and So I found out that having changed schools and being a little shy and small and insecure, that I could run with the kids that I wanted to run with and be popular and be cool. We didn't experiment with drinking to see what it tasted like, and I mean, we drank for the effect from the start. It was like, let's get some and let's get high, you know, on alcohol. Drugs hadn't really hit our schools, and fortunately for me, because I don't think I would have made it. So we drank to get drunk, and it was very occasionally. High school, it was a little more. I got a job in my sophomore year of high school. We were 3-year high school, 3-year junior high. And I got a job working at my dad's shop. I had to work at his shop because I'd gotten in quite a bit of trouble in junior high. I was kicked out of some classes, and then in high school I was kicked out of quite a few classes. And got caught shoplifting, got caught hanging a BA in front of the high school, you know, and or junior high, stuff like that. And he was a big, tough former Fresno State football player on a championship team, was a tackle that played offense and defense. And, you know, when he laid down the law, you really had to toe the line with him, because it was, you know, you either do what I say you're going to do, or there's these consequences, and when you're 18, you're on the street. And that's it. And so he had his apprentice pick me up every day at junior high after school, take me to his shop, and I'd have to sweep the floor and do my homework because I was screwing up so much. High school, I started working for him as an apprentice in his typesetting business. So I had a job, I had a car, and I wanted to be a man. You know, it was a crazy alcoholic home. You know, I wanted to go to college, you know, get married, start a family, and really just get out of there. That was kind of my road out. And the drinking progressed through high school, a lot of drunken parties, but I was never really a daily drinker. I didn't drink in the morning before school or anything like that. I settled down in my junior year and ended up doing really well academically and being senior class president and all that. Then I got up to Fresno State College, and the hippie thing was out there, and marijuana was out there, you know, and the psychedelics were out there, and boy, I just fell right off into that, you know, and right out of the fraternity I was pledging and all the drinking that was going on there, and that I did really well at, by the way. But I got off into that, you know, and ran with that for maybe 4 or 5 years. Ended up in it, living in a school bus on a commune in Oregon and all this malarkey. And we did go into those experiences. But what was interesting, you know, today I look way back on that stuff and I think, you know, even back then there was a spiritual quest that was going on and all of that with me. It was not simply being, you know, I didn't go off into hard drugs and shooting dope and stuff like that as some of my friends did, but there, I mean, we got into astrology, we got into Zen, we got into straight Buddhism, we started, you know, studied Hinduism and all this stuff, but I never really thought twice about going back to the religion of my childhood. I mean, that seemed way too controlling for me, I grew up in the Presbyterian church as a kid, and college became, but the drug thing did not work for me, and I'll tell you why, is because I didn't have control. I didn't, you know, I would get confused and screwed up and so spaced out on this stuff that I really couldn't go where I wanted my life to take me. But alcohol really, you know, I got back into alcohol, and then that worked. It made this anxiety go away. It made this not fitting in go away. It made all the big questions go away, and the hippie lifestyle go away. I started to get my focus back, come out of the fog, the acid fog, and you know, really start to want to do stuff with my life. And the alcohol let me do that. I ended up going to graduate school for 3 years, and it became about wine, it became about fine wine, it became about what food, you know, what wine goes with what food, what kind of glass goes with what wine, all the language of wine, and beer and so on later, and different, you know, foreign beers and blah blah blah, but it was all just more alcohol. What happened was that I proceeded along that way all the way through law school, drinking heavy through law school and the beginning of my job, and got hypnotized to slow down my drinking. That's a whole other story. But, you know, if I had more time, I would tell you more about it, because it gets goofier than that first laugh, believe me. In the end, it was just like what I did was I just knocked myself out every night with alcohol. I would just drink myself to a stupor every night. I wasn't a bar drinker. I was way too cheap for that. You know, I mean, I drank at home. When Liquor Barn came to Fresno, it was like a godsend, because it was like, you know, they, like Costco, they had these huge shopping carts. You could fill them completely with alcohol and go to the checkout stand, and that's what everybody else had. You didn't look strange at all. You know what I mean? It was just, that was normal. And I just knocked myself out. And one day, you know, I mean, I woke up drunker than I went to sleep. I was sleeping on 2 dog beds because I had a fight with my first wife. And I had half open beers and full beers around those dog beds. I knew that if I moved, I'd be down the hall to a .32 caliber semi-automatic, and I'd be dead. And that scared me, because I knew that somewhere between the dog bed and down the hall, I wouldn't be there anymore. Not meaning I would be dead, meaning that I would be out of the picture. It would not be about what I thought that moment would always be about, which would be me on top on the bridge or on top of the building, and the cops there and the firemen there, and people going, "Ernie, don't jump." Should I jump? Ernie, don't jump, you know? And I would just be gone. And, you know, the insight I gained in recovery later was that, you know, I had a moment of clarity. I didn't have the language for it yet, the vocabulary for it yet, but that I would die in a blackout. I would not be there in the decision-making process to take my own life. And, you know, we do fantastic things in blackouts. It's not just driving home and wondering the next day how you got there. I've heard stories by doctors who perform surgery in blackouts, and they come out of the blackout in surgery, and they have to learn to ask the questions just the right way so that no one knows they're drunk and coming out of a blackout, to find out if they're opening or closing, to find out what organ they're working on. and so forth. You know, I've got a friend in Fresno who tried a homicide case or a double homicide case out of state, you know, all the way to acquittal in a complete blackout. Does not even remember the trial. He was drunk and high the whole time. Totally blacked out. So we do these fantastic things. So to think that I could be capable of killing myself in a blackout is not surprising to me today at all. And that scared me enough to get me in to see a grief counselor that I'd seen when my dad died. I had 3 years without anything but two drinks during that hypnotism experiment. And then I had knee surgery. I took Vicodin, didn't get to pick it exactly as prescribed, and halfway through that prescription I went through all the alcohol in the house. So I didn't clear it out of the house. I had no program, just hypnotism. Right? The craving was gone. The obsession was gone through this hypnotic process, right? And anyway, I went on a 4.5 year run, and halfway through that my dad died and I could not grieve his death. So I'd seen this grief counselor. He ended up, I had to sober up. I took time off work. I had to sober up to go to the appointments. And he ended up giving me the 20 questions. I lied and I still flunked. He told me that I should stop drinking, and I never saw him again. And then I had that experience of that night. So that got me back to him. This time I had my tail between my legs. It wasn't hard to cry and just express my emotions and his feelings that I was having. He suggested that I go to a treatment. I went to an outpatient program. I was the first patient ever in their outpatient program. I was the only patient in their outpatient program. And they decided that wasn't working too well, so they made everybody who was finishing inpatient go to outpatient and sit with Ernie as part of their aftercare. And so I made it, and they told me to go to AA. And I've got a little Cadillac, and I've really expanded it on lease land and stuff at that time, and I had more cattle on the ground than I'd ever had. I was working full-time for the state of California as an attorney. And it was, they wanted me to go to AA. They wanted me to go there 3 nights a week and on Saturday, and they apparently didn't really know who they were talking to because I was busy. And so I compromised this whole situation and didn't go to AA. Then I managed to go to a couple of meetings, I think, in there. And my attitude was, look, I'm not drinking. Just leave the rest the F alone. You know? I mean, what else do you people want from me? I'm not drinking. And that lasted about 40 days. And at the end of 40 days, I like to say it rained on my parade for 40 days. I was so crazy, dry for 40 days, that I ended up with the very same solution I had on that morning that I woke up. Only this time I was completely dried out. Wrestled the gun away from my first wife. It was empty, and the clip was gone, and that just made me infuriated. She freaked out, called 911 and left, and I took off to another ranch with a shotgun, and I was going to go take care of myself. And along the way, I finally put together in my mind where this guy might live that I'd seen at one of those two meetings. Now, this guy, when I saw him at this meeting, he was looking, I was sitting up towards the front, and I turned around and I looked back, and he's going like this. And I'm thinking, Jesus Christ, I finally go to one of these meetings and this guy's back there blowing kisses at me, you know. Then I see my insurance man there, and I'm thinking, you know, now the insurance industry has sent him to investigate me about how much wine I said I drank when I got my life insurance policy. Well, then they finally called on this guy who was blowing these kisses, and I immediately recognized his voice. He's a guy I'd known probably 35 years earlier. I knew his sister. She was in my class. I knew him from junior high all the way through high school. He's a terrific football player for Fresno High. And he was going, Butch, Butch, because that was my nickname and that's what I was called. Butch, Butch. Well, when I heard him share, I realized it was Chuck, and I couldn't figure out how to get a hold of Chuck. And it dawned on me on the way up to this other ranch, and I called him. He came down, I asked him if he'd be my sponsor, and he said yes, and then three squad cars arrived. And they go, and he was a retired SWAT sergeant, so he goes, put your hands out the window and just lay them on the side and of the car door, and don't move. And so these officers get out of their vehicles, we're completely surrounded, boxed in, and this voice goes, Ernie Bank? And I go, yeah. You in there? Yeah. He says, step out of the vehicle. And I step out of the vehicle. And I've not been to prison. I've not been to jail. I've not been arrested. I've only ever been detained for a routine traffic violation. Okay. So this is a big deal in my little world. And he says, you any bank? And I go, yeah. He goes, you an alcoholic? And I go, yeah. He says, you having a bad day? And I go, yeah? And he says, well, my name's so-and-so with the last initial. And I've had this job I've been sober for 14 years, and I've had this job for 8 of them, and I want you to know it's going to be okay. And so I hugged him, like you're supposed to grab a hold of an officer. So anyway, he puts me in the back of the squad car, and then the next thing I know, my new sponsor is being ordered out of the vehicle at gunpoint. And it turns out that, they want to know if he's carrying any weapons, and he had a concealed weapon, and he had his identification for it and all that. So he talks them out of a 5150. Because the restraining order they were serving me with said I was suicidal, I was in possession of 14 guns, and so on and so on. So he talks them out of a 5150. I go back to his place, and then eventually back to outtreatment into a halfway house. Then I moved in with him for 3 months, and was a real space cadet, believe me. And then into another halfway house for 7 months. By then I had a second sponsor, and that kind of happened because I started doing a lot of H&I work. Chuck, this first sponsor, told me, when you're 6 months sober, you will be at the steps of the Fresno County Jail after having obtained a clearance, and you will go in on H&I, and the reason you'll do that is because that's what I did. And he also told me on this first day we got together, there's a guy named Matt G in Fresno. He had the same solution you had. The only difference is he pulled the trigger, and he survived. He's pretty deformed. You can't miss him when you see him and when you meet him. I said, well, call him up. I want to talk to him right now. And he said, no, you'll meet him in God's time, and that will be probably at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I show up at the steps of the jail. Who do you think standing there is Matt G? He's very involved in H&I, and we became best of friends. And so I kind of had two sponsors at the same time. I had a retired SWAT sergeant on one shoulder, and I had a retired outlaw on the other shoulder. Matt was a biker and had quite a criminal history before he got in here. And that fit me pretty well, because from the time I can remember, back to grade school, I either wanted to be a veterinarian. What do you want to do when you grow up, Butch? Well, I want to be a veterinarian. Or I think I'd like to join the Hells Angels. But I thought that was pretty cool. All the way to being kind of a latecomer to law school, having had an earlier career, and with my study group, the three guys that we all studied together, last day of contracts class, after the final and everything, so what are you going to do? What do you think you're going to do? And we kind of went around, and when it was my turn, well, I think I'm going to move back home to Fresno. I got family there. I've got 6 generations there. I'll go in the DA's office, practice for a few years, and then maybe run for judge. Or maybe I'll practice criminal law and get Sonny Barger out of prison. Well, he was the president of the Hells Angels at that time, and I saw nothing inconsistent about that. I never thought twice about it. I didn't have to think to make it up. It's just what came out of me. And fortunately, Alcoholics Anonymous has helped resolve a lot of that, and those two guys on my shoulders did. Well, eventually, I ended up with a third sponsor, and the way I got him was hanging around with Matt, hanging around with Chuck. Chuck was a very spiritual guy, a real deer hunter. And, you know, you prayed before you went out to hunt. When you got the deer, you prayed over the deer. You prayed over the meat, and you prayed before you ate. And you go to a restaurant with him, and him and his kids and wife would say prayers and stuff, and I'd be sliding down, you know, in the booth because I was so embarrassed by this. It was just not something that I was used to at all. And Matt's a very spiritual guy, and I learned the sound from being around them and the guys they hung around with, all of them probably 6 to 12 years sober, and I'm just this newbie guy. But I started to sound good. Not intentionally, it's just that's how I learned to talk. And I remember after this meeting in President, this gal says to me, "Oh, Ernie, I really liked what you had to share. It was so spiritual." And I'm walking out the door, and this old timer comes walking out. By then, he'd been sober probably 25 years. He's walking along, he walks up alongside me, and he goes, "I'll sure be glad when you do your 4-step. I am sick of hearing you whine." And so he's a guy I'd been warned by my brother-in-law to stay away from. My brother-in-law had been sober about 16 years, and he goes, "That guy's a real step Nazi. Stay away from him and this guy named Bob," such and such. And you know, it's funny, he said that, but I knew that's what I needed. Somebody who was going to be tough on me and take me through the steps. And so anyway, you know, going back to that, kind of what happened was that whole hitting bottom, getting introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous and getting introduced to the steps. And, you know, I remember that kind of that step one was, you know, don't change anything else. I'm not drinking. And I had to learn that I wasn't just powerless over alcohol. I was powerless over really pretty much everything, especially my head and what was going on in there, and powerless over her and powerless over people at work and so on. And I had to just start surrendering all this stuff to God. What does surrender mean? And it means a lot of things to a lot of people. But one thing it really means to me is quit thinking about it. Trust me, if you quit thinking about it, it's going to be okay. Because that obsessive mind kicks in. You know, my head is like a scanner. And it's looking all the time for something to obsess on. Some fear, some resentment, some concern, some worry. And the truth of the matter is, behind that person, place, or thing is a bottle. Okay? It's really just a bottle disguised as some person, place, or thing. When I start obsessing, and you don't want to be, I mean, and that obsession works like a scope on a rifle, you know, and I start dialing it in, and you get in the center of that and start to get real clear, you don't want to be there, because I can be a real asshole. And I don't want you there, because I don't want to get drunk, and I don't want that feeling that process creates. So that's the whole part of step one that I had to learn about. And in step two, that this power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And I didn't think I was crazy until I did my fourth and fifth step. And I thought, man, what a lunatic. You know, it wasn't just about drinking. And that chapter three, thanks for reading that. You know, when the first time I heard that part about all the things people do to control their drinking, I didn't know anybody else in the whole history of mankind had ever gone through that process. And that's because that's what I've been doing. And not even thinking I'm an alcoholic and I need to do that, but just kind of a way to take the heat off, slow things down, and so on and so forth. And, but you know, there's a whole lot of things that I did just over and over, the same way, expecting different results. And that's crazy. You know, all those character defects are part of that. And, so, you know, when I got to step three, I remember I was in this, when you're just kind of going through them for the first time with your sponsor, a lot of the stuff soaks in with time. But I remember I'm in that first halfway house. I'm laying on a bunk bed, and this is a guy who'd been to YMCA camp into my, you know, early teens, like 14 or 15. I quit going because I got my driver's license. But short of that, I mean, I'd been in this fraternity. I'd never lived in a fraternity house. I'd never been in the military. I got married at 19. So I slept with a woman. I didn't sleep in a room with a bunch of guys. And here I am, 44 years old, on a top bunk with seven other guys in this bedroom of this place, and they're running around in their shorts and snoring and farting, and I'm told to sleep with street shorts so I can keep all my valuables in my pockets at all times, because if you put it in a little cupboard they gave you, it'll be gone in the morning. And I'm looking up at the ceiling thinking, if I turn my will and my life over to the care, I'm out of the house on a restraining order, the marriage is going, I'm hanging on to my job by a thread, my mind is racing so fast they're putting me on medication. And I look up at the ceiling and I go, if I turn my will and my life over to the care of God, what if he screws it up? Like I had done this, you know, I had done this really great job with it all, you know. And so, you know, and I really think that that third step, that decision, is probably the, for me, and you know, some of this is opinion, most of this is experience. If I say something that's inconsistent with what your sponsor says or raises some question, go to your sponsor. Go with what your sponsor says. Anything I say like that, file it away for future reference, take it to your sponsor. But you know, that decision for me is central to the program. The first two steps get me to that decision, and all the rest of the steps are a process of carrying that decision into fruition. And the example I was always given is, you know, if there's three frogs on a lily pad, one makes a decision to jump off. How many are left, Ernie? Two. No. Three. One made a decision to jump off. He hasn't jumped yet. You're going to jump in 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. The fourth step showed me stuff like a resentment I had. I had a lot of resentments against my dad, and my sponsor wanted me to start there, would have had me start there, but for the separation and divorce that was consuming my whole thought process for like 2 years. So he had me start with her, and then when I got to my dad, just as an example, you know, I had this terrible resentment against my dad, and my sponsor had me write feelings in there too. And with my dad, they started with piss me off, and by the time I was done, it was hate. And I could never have admitted to anyone that I, deep down inside of me, I had this hatred for him and how he treated my mom and how he treated us. Although I loved him dearly, don't get me wrong, but there was this other part with just this fist of anger toward him. And he hounded me a lot about money. And the fact of the matter is, you know, I resented him for it. I rationalized all kinds of things about this obsession he had with me and this money issue. But the truth of the matter is, you know, I resented my dad because he hounded me about money. And it affected things like my ambition. I had plans for all my money and ways to invest it and where it was going to get me. And it affected my, you know, security instinct in the material way, because I didn't want to have to sacrifice to give him money. And it affected my social status. It was kind of embarrassing, you know, that I'd have to be giving my dad money. And I wouldn't be able to go to eat at the places I wanted to eat and travel the places I wanted to travel if I gave him this money he wanted. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, my part was that I had borrowed money from him, a substantial amount of money, to buy my first house. I'd signed a paper, okay, as a pre-law person, but I signed a contract to pay it back. And the time to pay it back had come and long gone. You know, but the way my head thought was that, by God, if you'd been the father you'd said you were going to be, if you'd done the things for me that you said you were going to do, you owe me money. I don't owe you shit. You know? Does that sound familiar, man? I mean, it's like that's the drunken Ernie. But the fact of it is, you know, I was a liar and a cheat and a thief. I was a taker. And a lot of other character defects in that relationship. And I have just a total blind eye to all of it. And that's what the fourth step started to tell me about Ernie. And, you know, the fifth step was something that, you know, I tried to do to everybody who would take time to listen. in little increments. I'd kind of emotionally and verbally throw up on any guy who'd take a little time to hear some terrible thing that I'd done. But the thought of telling one guy all of it, no way. You know, there were secrets I was going to take to my grave as well. I mean, the way I grew up, you couldn't be a man if you didn't have some secret or two that you weren't going to take to your grave. You know, something that's between you and your crime partner, or something that's not even between you and him. And so, you know, when I did my fifth step, my sponsor, this guy with all this sobriety, we prayed before we did it. We went through, he asked me time and again, you know, is there anything you left out? Anything you left out? And finally, that thing got out on the table. And then he shared with me a similar experience. And we prayed when we were done. He told me to go home and read the book and start on step six. He didn't call 911. He didn't count the silverware. He didn't tell me to not talk to his wife when I left the house, and so on and so forth. And so I went home and I did six and I did seven. Made my list. You know, I'm a great obsessive list, compulsive list maker. It's part of the way I got out of the fog in the hippie days. It's part of the way I sustained myself doing a lot of heavy drinking. If I had these lists and moments of clarity, I could go back and check them off. By the end of the drinking, the lists were pretty simple stuff, like doing the thing that's on your desk. I mean, when you get to work, that's pretty bad. And then I went over that list with my sponsor. He had me write out all my nice stuff, amends. And I can tell you, it's very unnatural. And they talk about pitching hardball as being a very unnatural act for a guy to have to start with his one foot in one place and keep it there as he's launched the ball as hard as he possibly could. And, you know, to do that, you ought to be throwing like an outfielder. That's a natural throw as hard as you can. And I would write out these amends, and even when I slow, you know, they say you think so fast, you talk a little slower, and you write even slower. So down to the slowest level, I would write, you know, I was wrong because da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But I'd even start to write. But you asked me to do this, you know, and I would start to rationalize. It was just it was amazing to me what I learned about me. I would go over those amends with him, and he would edit them, and then I'd take them and read them. An example of an amends I always like to share about is the one I made to my sister, who'd been in Al-Anon about 18, 20 years by the time I got sober. And I remember when my dad died, and I was still drinking. I was in that middle of that last 4.5 years of really bad drinking. He had retired, and there was a big safe that he had, probably stood about that tall, about this wide. And we didn't have the combination to it. It was at one of the house that he was living in. And I don't know what on earth made me think of it, but I had his bag of stuff from the hospital. You know, how they put all your valuables in a bag, and he died in the hospital. I'm going through it, and there's his wallet. And I just was looking through the stuff, and on the back of his Social Security card, there was a combination of the safe. So I'm drunk on tequila. I go down to his place. I open the safe, start looking through it, and I found $1,500 bills in an envelope. I took it. I spent it for an open bar at his funeral. I got just really drunk, and to help my daughter get to town, because she was living up in the state of Washington at the time. So, you know, my mom died in my first year of sobriety. So basically, she left everything. My dad left everything to my mom. My mom left everything to my sister and I. Half of that money that I took was my sister's. So among the other amends I made to her, and I owed her quite a few, was this financial amends. And so when I read her that amend, she said, okay, well, and she knew I was still going through this divorce, still hurting for money. She said, well, come up with a payment plan so you can pay me back. And then there's this pause, and she goes, with interest. And I thought, God damn it, you know, I'm the lawyer. I'm the one who's supposed to be that smart. So I guess what the lesson I learned from that I'll share with you is that if you owe a financial amends to an Al-Anon who's working a program, be prepared to pay interest. I got through those amends, and some of them were pretty humiliating, but all of them were just experiences I'd never had before. I'd never had an amends process in my life. And to go face to face with people and had to have gone over what I needed to say with somebody who was older and wiser in the spiritual journey I was on. And I continue to do that inventory process. I'll confess to you, I don't do it on a daily basis except on a spot check basis. I don't do a written 10-step every night. I'd probably be a much happier man if I did. But I've just never ironed out that part of the AA spiritual principles and the discipline that comes with them. That's where we need the power to carry it out. The 11th step, you know, I could talk about the 11th step for an hour by itself. I think that for me, I was told by Chuck, my first sponsor, on the first day I got together with him, that upon awakening, upon coming to consciousness, every morning I was to say, "Good morning, God." I had to learn that the first thought, I could retrain my mind, so that the first thought on my mind when I came to consciousness was God. Not me, and not my stuff, because I have that magic magnifying mind, that alcoholic mind, and we're done at 9:30. Is that right? So I've got to wrap this up. But you know, it's like Bob Earle talks about. You know, I mean, I can wake up and I reach down and scratch my leg, and it's a bump. No, it's a lump. No, it's a tumor. It's benign. No, it's malignant. You know, they're going to end up, you know, going to chemo and radiation, but it's not going to work out. They're going to have to amputate. You know, I'm going to lose my job, and then when I lose my job, I can't make my mortgage. The wife's not going to put up with that. I'm awake about 5 seconds, and I'm homeless, and I'm flat broke, and I'm all alone. You know, I mean, I definitely have that kind of mind. And so to retrain it to think about God first thing in the morning, "Good morning, God," and then I start with my morning prayers. And my morning prayers are ones that I've developed just through my own faith, and then I have the morning prayers that Chuck taught me. And those morning prayers are the first 3 steps, and the Our Father, and the 3rd step prayer, and the 7th step prayer, and the 11th step prayer. And I tell you, I can't say those prayers, particularly the 11th step prayer, without being convicted somehow. Something will flash through my mind where I haven't been one of those things that prayer is calling me to be. The 12-step work that I do today, I sponsor a lot of guys, and that's the primary 12-step work I do. And then I'm involved in an organization called The Other Bar, which helps lawyers and judges and law students with substance abuse issues, not just alcohol. So I've learned a lot about drug abuse since I've been involved in that program. And surprisingly enough, because lawyers run almost twice the national average for substance abuse issues, I get more 12-step calls through that program than I do through AA. It's incredible. My first job, especially if they're an alcoholic, is to get them to AA. That's part of the problem. They're a prosecutor like Roger used to be. They're prosecuting DUIs. They got a drinking problem. The last place they think, that keen alcoholic thinking, that they might want to go is something as public as these secret AA meetings. Because they might run into somebody they're prosecuting, or you're the judge. Or you're the attorney, and your defense attorney is scared to death that, you know, you show up in court and your lawyer's going, or your client's going to go, "I want a new lawyer. This dump truck is a drunk," you know, and let the whole courtroom know. I know. I saw him at the AA meeting you ordered me to go to, you know. So it's a predicament, you know, and these people hang out there in those dilemmas and they just die on the vine. It's amazing. But anyway, that's a lot of the 12-step work I do. Sponsoring guys, I mean, I learn more from the guys I sponsor, I'm sure, than I ever give them. They keep me sober. They keep me in the book. They keep me remembering what the newcomer mind is like, you know, because I can forget sometimes where I came from. And anyway, I guess that's enough for me. We've got 5 minutes left. Do I go to the very end, or do you guys have to close it up? So anyway, that's a lot of the 12-step work I do. You know, it's a spiritual program that we're in, and that's by choice if you're still here. I made that choice with that first step, and I've continued to carry that on. And, you know, the book talks about being catapulted into the fourth dimension, and the fourth dimension for me is the spiritual dimension. It's the spiritual plane. And my experience on the spiritual plane is that it's not benign. And by that I mean, when I'm in this spiritual life, it doesn't mean groovy, man. I mean, I'm just grooving all the time. I'm here in the spiritual world. You know, I'm happy, joyous, and groovy. You know, the spiritual world involves living life on life's terms and not necessarily doing what Ernie wants to do. Okay, my first impulse, my first reaction. It's trying to do what God would have me to do by following His will, which is to work these principles in my life. The spiritual world for me is a battlefield where that alcoholic mind is always fighting against the spiritual person that Ernie's become in Alcoholics Anonymous, and those values and those character assets, those character defects are coming at me all the time. And as powerless as I was over alcohol, I'm that powerless over my character defects. I can't think them away. I can't reason them away. I can't spank them away. But God can help me not just react with them. I can reach a place of neutrality most of the time with those spiritual defects, just like I found a place of neutrality with regard to drinking. I don't have to walk into the store and be all freaked out because I suddenly turned down the aisle with all the wine bottles. Remember what that was like when you were new? I mean, they're just jumping. They're just jumping out at you. You know, that we can actually be at dinner with people and there might be a bar in the background or there might be people drinking. It's all right. It's not a problem. Now, I could be working my program to do that. I have to be spiritually fit, which is, you know, maintaining my spiritual condition. I might have to pray while I'm there and so on. It's the same way with the character defects. It's exactly, if we surrender and we're powerless over them and God can restore us to sanity and we give them up, ask Him for power, and that power to resist that temptation is there. So thanks for letting me share. God bless.
Another great meeting, ladies and gentlemen. Do we have any AA announcements?
Yes, Tim, alcoholic.
Hi, Tim.
Speaking about Pat G, he will be speaking at the near East function for the central office that's been over in Lindsay this year. So Pat G will be the keynote speaker over there.
And I have good news. Roger was talking about Reyes. Reyes will be in this very room next month as our featured speaker. So show up. He's got a great pitch. Very spiritual. Very spiritual man. If that's it, we'll close in the usual manner.
Who's father?